It's the Bits and Pieces Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Bits and Pieces for March 2024. Indie podcasters Fiona and James here, and we're going to be sharing what's caught our eye this month. We will be dropping in to see what's going on at Holyrood and also Westminster. But what we try and do on this podcast is bring stuff that maybe you haven't seen in the news quite so much and that you might have missed. Now, March was a very significant month for First Ministers. First of all, Humza Yousaf marked the anniversary of 1 year in the job. Welsh First Minister Mark Drakeford resigned. And in the same week, and very unexpectedly, Irish Taoiseach Leo Varadkar also resigned.
So is that your overall theme for this week? Change?
Yeah. The Ides of March. Is that pushing it, do you think?
It's a little lanky, but...
You're listening to Bits and Pieces.
So we're going to start with Ireland, where Leo Varadkar's resignation certainly came as a bit of a shock to us. But it might be that it had its roots in something that happened a couple of weeks earlier. The Irish government held a referendum for a couple of what seemed fairly minor housekeeping amendments to their constitution, slight changes to wording to make it more reflective of current day society. One to do with the definition of a family, and the other to do with responsibilities for care. Now, the Irish Times podcast, Inside Politics, one of my favourites, had somebody reporting from the count. And before the final result was even known, there were indications that things were starting to go very badly off track.
The ballot boxes opened at 9 a.m. and I think it became evident within an hour or so that the early tallies were showing very much kind of the vote leaning, not only leaning no, but often in some of the cases in different ballot boxes, decisive no votes on both the care and family referendums. Now, this will be no surprise, realistically, to people within government who have seen the writing on the wall over the last number of days. They haven't really said it publicly, but they knew, I think, that defeat was coming in the care referendum. They thought maybe the family referendum, which is extending the definition of family, that would be salvageable. Having said the fact that they felt that, you know, the writing was on the wall, I don't think anybody within government predicted the scale of the no vote. I've covered the referendum here before, the abortion referendum and also the same-sex marriage referendum. I cannot tell you how different the atmosphere is. I mean, there are many different government figures around here today, different ministers, glum faces everywhere. And I think this is an absolute drubbing in some ways. And Taoiseach Leo Varadkar just described it there as not only a wallop, but two wallops. Already the blame game is starting, and you're going to see, I think, potentially significant fallout because of the scale of the no vote.
In the days to follow, Inside Politics podcast tried to make sense of the result.
Just to remind everyone of the basic facts, the turnout in the referendums was 43.6%. 67.69% of voters said no to the proposal to extend the definition of the family, and 73.93% said no to the proposal to delete references to women in the home and add a reference to the role of carers.
If I was to sum up how they were feeling on Sunday into Monday, it was pretty shook up. My original thought was, look, you know, this is a thing. It matters. It's important. But the read across to, you know, party political elections is probably limited. It'll spend a few days in the news cycle and will wash through. In some ways, I still believe that. But talking to people on Saturday night and Sunday morning, and I was just really, really taken aback by how rattled people were. It's the scale of it. They could handle losing it, but it's the scale of it. It's what it says about their own judgment, about how they can assess the impact of the electorate, how they judge themselves to be doing a good job in framing and wording the proposals. But the big thing that stuck with me most was this idea of increased voter volatility. Just the idea that the electorate is extremely difficult to predict, and that this result may be an expression of some underlying instability or disgruntlement within the electorate, which is very difficult to predict how that will manifest itself.
Still no inkling at that time that the following week this was going to happen.
When I became party leader and Taoiseach back in June 2017, I knew that one part of leadership is knowing when the time has come to pass on the baton to somebody else and then having the courage to do it. That time is now. So I am resigning as President and Leader of Fine Gael effective today, and will resign as Taoiseach as soon as my successor is able to take up that office.
He gave no specific reason for his resignation, saying only,
"My reasons for stepping down are both personal and political."
But there was perhaps a clue right at the end of his speech.
"Politicians are human beings, and we have our limitations. We give it everything until we can't anymore, and then we have to move on."
And it is interesting that relatively young politician Leo Varadkar joins two other relatively young politicians in stepping down at a time they choose. That's Jacinda Ardern, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, and of course Nicola Sturgeon. Perhaps they all just reached a point in their lives when they thought, there's other things I could be doing. Now, we're looking in from the outside, of course, but do you have any thoughts on the referendum result?
The impression I was left with after hearing about this for the first time was that it sounded like, through a grassroots movement, they had managed to weaponize progressive sentiment against progressivism.
The campaign seems to have been extremely grassroots led in order to change the message so that instead of it being a couple of housekeeping changes that were more reflective of current society, they were seen as anti-women, anti-disabled people. It was quite a turnaround.
Well, that's the funny thing, is that in another context it would make sense. In the context of they were changing these things, essentially making them worse, i.e. removing women and then sort of instilling some new wording that was like, men are the best, men are the greatest, only men can have families, then yeah, that would absolutely be the progressive stance, is to go, no, you absolutely can't remove women. But actually, it's that this was a progressive thing that was in fact a couple steps behind how progressive they were trying to be. Right, yeah, but we were actually trying to broaden that. It was even more people than just women. Everyone.
It just shows you, you know, a written constitution can only be changed if the majority of the public agree with that change. The other thing is there's been criticism of the case that the Irish government put forward. You're not putting much effort into publicising the benefits of the change they were trying to make. It was almost as if they kind of took the electorate for granted that they would carry on and they would go with what they said, which is always a really dangerous thing to do. And it might be that some of the no vote was a kind of anti-establishment vote because the people were annoyed at their housing issues that they've got in Ireland, various other things that like every other society, they have issues with. But equally, it could just have been that it was weaponized by who knows who. I was quite struck by a newspaper article interviewing people who had voted yes to the amendments. And they spent time, they looked at the pros and the cons, they'd done some research and they'd weighed it up and they thought, yes, actually, yes is the right thing to do. The people who voted no, quoted in this article, it was much more of that emotional populist, no, you're eradicating women, without any great logic behind it, which kind of has ripples and resonances of the Brexit vote and, you know, the Make America Great Again, all these populist waves.
Yeah, it kind of smacked of a knee-jerk reaction.
Again, it just shows you cannot take the electorate for granted, something that's very relevant in Scotland as well, of course. Now we're going to move on to Wales, where Mark Drakeford, First Minister, resigned. This was expected. He had said for a while that he was going to step down. So the Senedd elected his replacement this week, who is Vaughan Gething, a Zambian-born lawyer. And this is a clip from his first speech as First Minister.
As First Minister, I look forward to standing up for Wales and for devolution in the weeks and months to come. But I relish the opportunity to cooperate for Wales with a new UK government that invests in partnership and in Wales's future.
Obviously, assuming there that the next government at Westminster will be Labour, which it might well be, and that will give Wales a somewhat different backdrop to their politics, I would expect. He also commented on the very significant piece of history that his election represents.
Today voted also to ensure that Wales becomes the first nation anywhere in Europe to be led by a black person. It is a matter of pride, I believe, for a modern Wales, but also a daunting responsibility for me, and one that I do not take lightly.
So we'll be watching Von Gethin with interest to see how he measures up to his predecessor. We're going to miss Mark Drakeford. He might be an old unionist, but he really has never let the UK government off the hook, and he's been a passionate champion of devolution and fairness, I think. This next clip is a little tribute to him, and it is the evidence that he gave at the COVID inquiry in relation to Boris Johnson's refusal to admit that health was devolved.
In that Cobra meeting, we have a very direct rehearsal with the Prime Minister of the need for him to be clear in a press conference, which he's told us he's about to have. So we know the decision's made because he's got a press conference lined up to announce it. In that press conference, he must make it clear that what he's about to say does not apply in Wales or Scotland or Northern Ireland. And he gives assurances in the Cobra meeting that he will do his very best to make sure he does that. He then heads to the cameras. He provides a script in front of the cameras in which the only time he refers to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland is when he says early in the press conference, as Prime Minister of Scotland, England, Wales and Northern Ireland. It is a very clear indication to people that what he's about to say applies to the whole of the United Kingdom. And he never once says that that is not the case. That's why I describe it as a bleak moment, because this is not a moment when, and I understand that people can use Britain, United Kingdom, England interchangeably, if that's the way they've been brought up. But in this case, this is not a slip of the tongue. This is not somebody forgetting to mention. This is a deliberate attempt to imply to people that what the Prime Minister is about to say means them, when he full well knew that he didn't.
I think in previous bits and pieces we've covered Nicola Sturgeon giving evidence to that COVID inquiry and saying much the same. But I think he says it even more clearly, you know, that Johnson, he was trying to give the impression he was talking for the whole of the UK, even though he'd actually assured them minutes before he was going to do the opposite. It just gives you an insight into the sort of duplicity of the man.
You're listening to Bits and Pieces.
We're going to talk a little bit about constitutions in this next section. I'm staying with Wales for the moment because after 2 years of study, the Independent Commission on the Constitutional Future of Wales has reported in the last week or so, there's been a debate in the Senate about the results, which we are going to feature as a separate show because it's very interesting stuff. But just as a taster for that, another podcast that I enjoy very much is Kirsty Hughes' European Conversations. And she interviewed one of the commissioners who'd been on that project. And in this next clip, she describes how they went about engaging people in the conversation, particularly those people who don't normally get their views expressed.
So the commission was explicitly tasked with having a national conversation with the people of Wales about its constitutional future. Now, that's quite a difficult thing to do because in our experience, most people that we talked to didn't have a very good understanding of how Wales is governed at the moment in order to be able to think about what the options for the future might be. Nor were they perhaps, was it clear to them, you know, how do these questions matter to them? How does it relate to the things that do matter to them? Like health, transport, and so on. So there was a really big job of work there for us to think of how we were going to talk to people in different ways about the constitutional options. A couple of ways that we did that. So we organised deliberative citizens panels across different parts of Wales. And the design of those were really important in that, you know, part of the purpose of those was to give information about how things work at the moment, to then help people think through different ways in which that could work differently in the future. So informing in order to have discussion, a meaningful discussion about different options for the governance of Wales. We also then had a community engagement fund where we, again, worked with community partners deliberately to try to talk to people who wouldn't typically, you know, engage in a public consultation. And they involved groups such as, for example, children, young people who had been in care, people who had experienced different kinds of social exclusion and social injustice. So lots of, again, very different groups across Wales. And the innovative element there was that we really encouraged groups to think for themselves how they would like to engage with the questions that we were interested in and design their own engagement activities. And that meant that we ended up with a huge amount of variety. Some more conventional ways of talking about these things, focus group surveys, but also really fun things like we had a hackathon, people were writing raps, poetry, songs. So really very creative ways of talking about questions which are, you know, quite complex, quite difficult, and that often people hadn't thought about before. And our experience was that actually, if you spend time thinking about how to ask these questions, avoiding jargon and, you know, the technical legalistic language that we often use when we're talking about constitutional change, people have a view and they want to be heard.
I think we have at least done a decent job in communicating that what we think a constitution is quite simple. What are our values? What can't we stand?
Yeah, exactly. And if you're part of this society, here's your protections and here's your responsibilities. I do think it's interesting that people in Wales, because they've not been through that referendum experience, are perhaps much less cited on issues like what is a constitution. Whereas I think in Scotland, for all it was 10 years ago nearly, the referendum, it really did put our constitutional situation very much in the forefront. You know, people know that it's an issue, mm-hmm. Even if they maybe don't know what the alternatives are even. So the next clip, talking about constitutions, you'll recall that this is something that SNP agreed to at their last conference, that there should be a constitutional convention. However, when Stephen Flynn was a guest on the TNT show, he was asked about it, and it did sound as if the whole thing had been kicked into the long grass. Sounded to me like that anyway. See what you think.
The SNP policy is to put together a constitutional convention like happened in the case of devolution. An old friend of mine helped to put that together, Canon Kenyon Wright, and it was hugely successful. Not everyone participated. The SNP didn't, and I can't remember if the Tories participated fully. But nonetheless, it had enormous impact. It wasn't just a party or a series of parties speaking. It was the Scottish people speaking. And that's very hard to deny. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah, and particularly when you're bringing together the political world and the civic world in Scottish daily life. And I think there's a huge power that lies underneath that, and you're right to touch upon it. You're also right to touch upon the fact that it is obviously something which was agreed by the party at its conference. And I'm hopeful that we can get to a point where we can bring that together. Of course, one of the big barriers to that happening in probably the coming months is a general election. I can't imagine there's going to be many partners who are going to want to delve into that in advance of the public going to the polls.
So nothing happening, at least until after the election, by the sound of it, which I think is missing an opportunity of having something positive to put to the electorate. And John Drummond also put this to Stephen.
Isn't it an argument, though, taking your point about an upcoming election, that the independence position, generally speaking, would be strengthened prior to election if the Scottish people were told categorically there will be a constitutional convention. These are the groups who will be represented. Then people will know that one of the outcomes of that election is the very thing that you've said is desirable, i.e. there will be a constitutional convention. It's not a debate, it's not a discussion. This will take place. And this is the timing of that. In other words, whatever the outcome is, and you would expect the SNP support to be a little bit greater than it is just now, because even though the figures for independence have remained fairly solid over the years, the SNP support, according to opinion polls, has not. And that might be a way of engendering a warmer feeling amongst the electorate, dare I say, if you were able to say, this is what's going to happen, categorically, no question about it.
So I don't disagree with the premise of what you're saying. What I would maybe do is be a little bit of a devil's advocate in terms of the practicalities of that, because of course the only way to bring a constitutional convention together is to have willing participants, and it's probably going to be a little bit challenging for some people to agree to sign up to something in advance of an election and say it's definitely happening. But as a point of principle, in terms of what we want to see achieved, the party has been clear in that regard. And, you know, the sooner we can do that, the better. But we do need all partners to come together, those who believe in independence and those who don't, and those from right across all aspects of Scottish society, to come forward to chart that path forward, because we need the logjam to be broken. Yeah, we can't continue to sit with 50% of the people of Scotland believing in something, and then obviously the politicians in Westminster turned in a blind eye to that because of the basis of where power rests in these isles.
Absolutely.
And then in true Colombo style, John had a follow-up question.
Oh, by the way, who is responsible for setting up the convention? Who is doing that?
You're testing me there. Let me come back to you on that one, John.
So it's something he hopes can happen in the future, once the election's over, and he's no idea who's bringing it about.
Yeah, I found it kind of interesting that he seems to view it very much in the lens of that this constitutional debate will be led by political parties, which is actually, at the moment, not really the sentiment. Actually, people are trying to get it so that it's almost divorced from the realm of political parties, and it really is just a people thing. But I got the impression from what he was saying, it's like, yeah, he's talking about political players. He's saying, oh, well, I don't know what the state of the political chessboard will be. And we're going, well, we actually were looking for a thing that, regardless of what the state of the chessboard is, could go forward.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, that was something that the SNP agreed to at their conference. But is it the SNP's to lead on? I wouldn't say it was. They certainly be invited to be part of it, as would all the political parties. But it has to be something bigger than that. Otherwise, it's just another political bun fight, I think.
There is sense, actually, in a way, in what he's saying, in that technically, if the state of the chessboard is that the SNP loses power entirely, then even if you have an independent body coming up with a great constitution, technically, if no one ever takes it on board and signs it into law, then yeah, right enough.
Yeah, there has to be a political element to it, but it can't be just a political element. Let's move on to the next clip then. Having heard that the SNP doesn't think now's the time to be looking at a constitution, there is a group of people who decided that actually they will just get on with it. And the Scottish Independence Forum, I think it was called, had a meeting that had representatives from different independence groups got together in Stirling and decided that they were going to take forward a constitutional convention. So this was a planning meeting that they had just to scope it out and see how they would approach it. So here are some of the inputs from that discussion.
The purpose of the convention should be to create a new vision for an independent Scotland, a vision that can be enabled and accepted even by those initially cautious.
We also felt that it should look at an elected parliament, a first chamber, elected on a form of proportional representation, and definitely not first past the post. There should also be a second chamber, the detail of that to be discussed and looked into by the convention.
One of the key things about conflict is not about winner takes all. That's a British way. It's about building consensus, making sure everybody wins something.
If the people of Scotland are sovereign, which they are, it's the National Convention which should hold and exercise the sovereignty of the people of Scotland.
We're actually talking about is to address Scottish society, to bring together Scottish society. And the purpose is clearly going to be, for that, these discussions, is that we want to promote constitutional change. Now, I've heard mention of self-determination, I've heard mention of independence. At the moment, I don't think that that's something that we have to decide, but I think that if we broaden it and make it as wide as thinking about self-determination, then, as has been said, that allows more groups to come in. So I'm just going to leave this as constitutional change, and we'll think about what that means later.
But at the same time, we're dealing with powerful opponents who will use, and I'm not talking about conspiracy theories, they will use powerful conduits to keep the movement, the broader idea, suppressed.
Well, we were looking at the new version of the estates with sectors of society, young people, pensioners, trade unions, churches and others basically putting forward their representatives. Possibly, it could even be a lottery from within these because it changes over. It's a kind of like being on a jury. That's how we saw it. And it kind of takes away, to a certain extent, the elective element, but it keeps it being sort of the people and properly, equally democratic.
In winding this up, we've agreed that we are going to have a national convention. I personally think probably should be set up sooner rather than later, and it should try and encourage folk from out with the nationalist pro-indie bubble to come and join us. And to do that, we perhaps have to cover future governance rather than just independence alone.
I was quite interested in the contrast there between Wales sets up a two-year-long consultation process with independent experts, and we have a load of volunteers get together in Stirling and try and thrash out what we're going to do. You've got to give them kudos for the effort, and clearly they're putting a lot of thought into it.
It's pretty much, it's an issue of scale. It's a group that wants to get the nation as a whole to have an opinion on something.
Yeah.
And as we have run into a thousand times before, the eternal brick wall, that is that we don't control the television media, which means word of this will not get out on the usual airwaves that Joe Lunchpail uses.
Well, to be fair, they did also talk about putting papers out, which kind of, you know, the Scottish Government is putting papers out.
Right.
It's.
I refer you back to Joe Lunchpail. How many papers do you think Joe Lunchpail has read?
And
that would be zero, Jenkins.
There's already a lot of papers. But having said that, SNP aren't doing anything. These guys are trying to at least do something. So you've got to give them props for that. Is it going to have any impact? Don't know. Jury's out.
I've had a brainwave. Let's go radical. What if we're thinking too broad? What if, rather than these guys coming up with a fantastical constitution for Scotland, what if we just go, even if it's just at the moment, on the council areas? Maybe they can come up with a great constitution for Stirling. Different council areas can come up with their own constitution. Then, if there's some kind of interconnection between those groups, because they're working on smaller scales, you can knit those together into the constitution
for
Scotland.
The United States of Scotland!
No one mentioned states, but yeah. But yeah, actually that's probably how I would tackle the issue of scale, is actually you would even maybe get it on the level of towns. Like, we do, what's the constitution of your town? And then, unfortunately, you get a lot of levels of management here. You go, well, towns up to counties up to country.
You also have the risk that somewhere, like, you know, there's a hanging judge appointed in Alloa, for example. There's got to be some kind of ground rules. But actually, I do like that idea, because that is the way we should be going, is much more local. And that would bring us more into line with the rest of Europe, where decision making and local democracy is at a much, much, much lower level than anything we've got. So, you know, you put that forward as a bit of fanciful nonsense, but actually that could be the answer. That's not a terrible suggestion.
So yeah, no, that is how I would do that, and also, unfortunately, in the interest of democracy, yeah, you are going to get towns where the entire populace goes, yes, our values are in fact incredibly racist and backwards thinking, but that's what you get when you actually really do go on a countrywide level, we're trying to get everyone involved. You can't actually go, except these people who don't agree with me, you know?
Yes, interesting.
You're listening to Bits and Pieces.
And just talking of grassroots activism and not waiting for the politicians to fix everything, Believe in Scotland is really stepping up the pace of their activities. We chatted to Gordon McIntyre Kemp about some of the things that are coming up, starting with the march and rally in Glasgow on the 20th of April.
The march and rally in particular, it's part of a whole weekend of activities, but the march and rally starts on Kelvin Way, which is the pedestrianised road that goes along by Kelvin Grove Park up to the university. So we're asking everyone to gather there from 11:30, 11:45, etc. And the march will start at 12:30. then goes through the town in the usual route. And we are finishing the march and having the rally in George Square, which obviously is really good for transport, Queen Street Station, etc., and pubs and things afterwards, and places to eat and shop as well. Yeah. But for that weekend, we've got committee rooms at 7:30 for the after party. There will be tickets going on sale for that. And then on the Sunday, we're meeting at Langside Hall, which is the base for the day for the Southside activities, from 10:30 a.m. till 2:30. So, you know, we've got a whole weekend of activity going on. And I would hope as many people as possible will make it along to that. You know, if you can't make it, it will be broadcast live as well.
Gordon also mentioned Action Day on the Sunday following the march. This will be the third of Believe in Scotland local action days, where they descend on a particular town and do a lot of leafleting, have some stalls, etc. They've held them so far in Perth, and the most recent was in Linlithgow. We were there, we filmed it. If you want to see that film, it's on our YouTube channel. We also had a chat with one of the activists, whose name I think was Angela.
I made it up here on the bus from Edinburgh just in time for the 10:30 gathering. There was a huge crowd of us earlier, so...
Oh, that's great.
Oh, yeah, so yeah. Everybody else, you know, we're kind of manning the stalls.
Yeah.
Giving out leaflets as people go past.
Yeah.
They're all, like, door-dropping Leaving Scotland leaflets.
It's really well organised. Well organised.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
So how about yourself? You optimistic?
Whatever happens, demography will win.
Yeah, that's right.
Because 10 years ago, the under 30s were very much in favour of independence, and the under 40s were maybe a little, and now it's under 50s are very much in favour, and 50 to 60 about 50%, and then sadly the over 60s but then you see that's a problem that's mending itself.
Yes.
And as people get older, they're not becoming more conservative, they're not becoming more unionist as they get older. I'll be 70 soon. I know that the first 5-10 years of an independent Scotland, it'll be quite hard financially. But I'm doing this for my millennial children.
The support for EU, that's just keeping going.
It's fantastic.
As well,
yes, absolutely.
So that all helps, doesn't it?
I have two sons. One lives in the Netherlands with his Dutch partner, and the other one lives in Glasgow with his Italian girlfriend.
It's
how forward and progressive and outward looking we are, and being held back by this union with Westminster is terrible.
It is,
I'll just say it's terrible.
It's sort of almost exhausting now. It's so bad.
You're listening to Bits and Pieces.
We're going to move on to Holyrood. A couple of really important bills passed in Holyrood this month. And the first one we're going to look at is the Muirburn Bill. Now, we are particularly interested in this because Marlene and I went to the Revive Conference in Perth, and we did a whole Mibby's Eye episode on, you know, grouse moor management, raptor persecution. And if you want to look at that, you'll get it on our YouTube channel, wherever you get your podcasts. So this is the closing speech from Jim Fairley at stage 3 of the debate on the Muirburn Bill.
Presiding Officer, as someone whose entire life has until very recently been bound by the rhythms of nature, the ebb and flow of seasons, the understanding of new life, and of course the acceptance of death that is the reality of our natural environment, then it's perhaps fitting that this has been my first bill as a minister. And it is vital part of the Scottish Government's wider programme of work to protect and restore our wildlife, biodiversity and natural environment. Today, most folk in our country, and most certainly in this government, absolutely get that farmers play a vital role in our society and in serving the nation. But it's not that long ago where it was farmers who were seen as the villains. With the BSC, Frankenstein Foods and Foot and Mouth, all these things had the industry on the rack and feeling as though they were public enemy number one. As a young shepherd with a very young family in a tied house, I am well aware of the anxiety that that uncertainty can bring. During this bill, we have been reminded of that uncertainty that hangs over a group of rural workers in regards to housing, which the Housing Minister has agreed to meet with me to discuss, but I will revisit that at a later date. But by engagement with the public, by looking at the positive stories, by reminding folk of the good work farmers do, the narrative started to change and attitudes changed with it. We now have a healthy relationship between farmers and consumers, which is to be celebrated and continued. That, presiding officer, is the opportunity which the passing of this bill affords the rural practitioners on grouse moors and in game businesses. It's a demonstration that this industry is regulated and adhered to by hard-working, responsible people who love the natural environment as much, and if not more so, than we all do. And that should be celebrated. When taking this bill forward, the government and all the ministers who have helped this passage were clear that balance was the key to making this legislation work for all. Our aim was clear. The tiny number of bad apples should be weeded out. We will be far more considered in our burnings. We will have the highest standards of animal welfare that demonstrates this industry will do its job better than anyone could have imagined was possible. And it will gain the respect that it so richly deserves by being the custodians of the landscapes and of the standards that society expects and wants. So, presiding officer, I would urge the industry to grab this opportunity and make it their quest to be recognised, not just in Scotland but across the world, as the beating heart of an environment we can all be proud of for generations to come.
The result of the vote on motion 12535 in the name of Jim Fairley is yes 85, no 30. There were no abstentions. The motion is therefore agreed and the Wildlife Management and Muirburn Scotland Bill is passed.
The Hate Crime Bill is going to become law on the 1st of April. If it was up to me, I maybe would have chosen a different date. But there is huge misinformation going around about this. And Douglas Ross spent all his questions at FMQs ratcheting up the hysteria, I would say, about it. Possibly as a result of criticism he's received, he's speaking much more quietly. So I think he's making an effort to be less shouty. But it doesn't mean that what he's saying is any more sensible, which you will hear.
We voted against this law and still oppose it as a serious risk to free speech. But in just 11 days' time, the police will have to enforce it. David Kennedy, the General Secretary of the Scottish Police Federation, has said this about training. We're only receiving a two-hour online training package. First Minister, is that really enough for a complex and controversial piece of legislation?
First of all, let me say, as when it comes to the Hate Crime Act, there has been a lot of disinformation that has been spread on social media and some inaccurate media reporting and indeed by our political opponents. So I'm hoping this exchange we can shed more light than heat on what is actually in the Act as opposed to what is being said about it. In terms of training for police, let me say that I leave it as an operational decision and a matter for the Chief Constable to determine what training is absolutely appropriate. And of course, Police Scotland put out a statement just this week to challenge some of, in their words, the inaccurate media reporting that exists around the Hate Crime Act. So I've got absolute confidence in Police Scotland to ensure the appropriate training is in place. And I would urge the Conservatives, I would urge Douglas Ross, that it would be far better for him, I think, to put more effort into tackling hatred as opposed to opposing a Hate Crime Act.
This seems to be a fair point to me. I don't see how demanding the right to use hate speech and stir up hatred can ever be a good look. However, Douglas Ross doesn't see it that way.
We opposed the legislation at the time and still oppose it now because of the impact it has on free speech for people across this country. And I'm only reiterating the points made by the Scottish Police Federation, the representative body of our officers across Scotland. They say that their officers can barely deal with existing crimes, let alone this new law.
He's just leapt into a whole different ballgame there. He's gone from complaining about it sort of criminalising free speech, which it doesn't. He's complained that there's not enough training, although we don't know what's included on that training, whether it's adequate or not. And now he's leapt into the police can barely deal with the crimes they've got, let alone all these new crimes.
Hamza Yusuf has reduced officer numbers to the lowest level since Police Scotland was formed. Now officers are being told not to investigate actual crimes, but instead they'll have to look for the hate monster.
or police free speech. Criminals will be let off while innocent people are prosecuted.
He's just ratcheted up another level of nonsense.
He's being intentionally misleading.
Police won't investigate any crimes because they're too busy checking up on free speech. It's just nonsense. Shameful.
It implies that the police don't have any reasoning or triage, that they will quite literally, on the streets, see someone snatch a purse and out of the other eye see someone calling someone a slur and go, well, I better deal with that slur.
There's a bank robbery being committed.
And at some point during it, one of the tellers calls one of the robbers a slur and the police officer comes in and goes, wait a minute, hold on, you can't say that.
Isn't Hamza Yousaf setting the police up for failure and undermining public trust in policing?
Presiding officer, with that contribution, it is Douglas Ross who is undermining the fight against hatred here in Scotland. Through so much disinformation, I don't even know where to begin. So let's take point by point of what Douglas Ross has said. First and foremost, he makes an incorrect claim around police officer numbers under the SNP government. Of course, under the SNP government, numbers of police officers have increased and will continue to increase. And of course, there are more police officers per head in Scotland than in England, where his party is, of course, in charge. I remember, of course, because I was the Justice Secretary that took forward this bill, making sure that I engaged with opposition members around the issue of freedom of expression. There is a triple lock of freedom of expression in the Act. There is protection of freedom of expression that's actually explicitly embedded in the Act. There's also a defence available of a person's behaviour being reasonable, which safeguards people's rights. And thirdly, of course, the Act itself is compatible with the European Convention on Human Rights, including Article 10, which includes and protects everybody's right to freedom. When it comes to stirring up of hatred, Presiding Officer, the stirring up offences are so pervasive, so damaging, so dangerous in our society. Let me just take Douglas Ross back to what Lord Bracadale said. Lord Bracadale, of course, was the one who reported on his independent review of hate crime, which then led to the development of legislation. He said, and I'll quote, "The stirring up of hatred can contribute to a social atmosphere in which prejudice and discrimination are accepted as normal." Yep. In any society, Presiding Officer, the freedom to criticise, the freedom to insult, the freedom to offend exists and should be treasured, in fact. But there cannot be freedom to engage in behaviour that is threatening or abusive and intended to stir up hatred. Yep. So everybody in this chamber, we engage, we talk often about our commitment to tackle hatred. Those who experience hatred tell me they don't just want warm words from their politicians, they want action, and that's exactly what this Hate Crime Act intends to do.
Next, there was a slightly tit-for-tat game of my lawyer is bigger than your lawyer.
Let's look at another legal expert, this one Professor Adam Tompkins, I think known to Douglas Ross, formerly a Conservative MSP, somebody I worked with in relation to the hate crime bill. And he's of course a professor of public law, and I'll quote from him directly. "Offensive speech is not criminalised by this legislation. The only speech relating to sexual orientation, transgender identity, age or disability outlawed here is speech which, one, a reasonable person would, two, consider to be threatening or abusive, three, which was intended to stir up hatred, and four, was not reasonable in any circumstances." He goes on to say, "Just because you feel offended by what someone does not make it a hate crime." And then goes on to say, "Under the Hate Crime Act, the threshold of criminal liability is not a victim that feels offended, i.e. a subjective test, but that a reasonable person would consider the perpetrator's actions or speech to be threatening or abusive." So, Presiding Officer, let's stick to the facts. And the facts are this, that we are all purport to be concerned about the rises in hate crime that we've seen in our society over the years. But there's only some parties in this chamber that I believe are willing to take the action that is necessary to tackle it.
I think that explanation there that he's just given from Adam Tompkins is really quite clear, and it really takes the froth and the hysteria away. But does Douglas Ross give up? No.
Let's remember Hamza Yousaf introduced this unworkable and dangerous law when he was Justice Secretary. Now he's bringing it into force as First Minister with little training and not enough support for the officers who will have to enforce it. We've said from the outset this law is a disaster in the making.
It criminalises free speech. It risks a fundamental right. It's overreached by the SNP into people's homes. It could result in the public being criminalised for no good reason. It is set to be a shambles from day one.
And by this point, Hamza seemed to just lose patience with Douglas Ross and went for him with both barrels.
What's dangerous, presiding officer, isn't the law. What's dangerous is hate crime in our society. And maybe, presiding officer, it's hardly a surprise, given that the Conservative Party, far from working hard to tackle hatred, they're a party that have actively created the conditions for hatred and division to thrive in our society. Absolutely. The Conservative Party, presiding officer, the Conservative Party are the party of go-home vans, the party of the hostile environment, the party of Windrush, the party whose leader, Boris Johnson, called Muslim
briefly,
women,
First Minister.
Bank robbers. They are a party that indulges in Islamophobic smears from Suella Braverman to Lee Anderson. So instead of fighting against this bill,
briefly,
wouldn't
First
it be better,
Minister,
officer, that the Conservatives got their own house in order?
You will have noticed there the presiding officer getting a little bit impatient with Hamza and repeatedly asking him to be brief. Well, this spilled over into the next question, and this time she really had had enough. She cut off his microphone, moved on to the next question, which received a one-word reply in the tone of a sulky schoolboy. Oh dear.
Briefly, First Minister.
And that is why, of course, is imperative throughout all of these challenges that governments and political parties make a decision. Do they invest in public services?
Thank you, First Minister. We must move on to the next question. First Minister.
Is it?
First Minister. First Minister, I have asked that you conclude your question. I am now moving on to the next question. Question number three, Alex Cole-Hamilton.
Thank you very much, Presiding Officer. To ask the First Minister when the Cabinet will next meet.
First Minister.
Tuesday.
The last bit from Holyrood this month, a motion put forward by Tom Arthur to withhold consent to a piece of legislation coming up from Westminster. And I think this is probably a really important point. I know that the Welsh Government also were quite outraged about the terms of this.
The UK Government's Economic Activity of Public Body Overseas Matters Bill engages the legislative consent process because it would limit the executive competence of the Scottish ministers in relation to devolved matters. The bill would apply to all public bodies in Scotland and across the UK. But our consideration today is particularly in respect of its impact on the Scottish ministers, which triggers the need for legislative consent. The bill would limit the executive competence of Scottish ministers by preventing them from taking a moral or political disapproval of any foreign state conduct into account in devolved procurement and investment decisions. Not only that, but it would also make it unlawful for the Scottish ministers to publish a statement saying that they intend to take such matters into consideration, or even that they would intend to take such matters into consideration were it not unlawful to do so. It places the policing and enforcement of this into the hands of UK ministers. The Secretary of State is given sweeping powers to compel the Scottish ministers and other public bodies to provide information. They are given powers to issue compliance notices, setting out the actions which the Scottish ministers should take or refrain from taking. And they are given powers to fine the Scottish ministers, subject to interest, should he or she conclude that the terms of that compliance notice have been breached. And all of this, remember, is in relation to decisions that the Scottish ministers may take about otherwise entirely devolved matters.
The vote went his way, so Holyrood has refused consent, which under the Sewell Convention ought to be an end of it. He wants Scottish ministers excluded from the scope of the bill. This is Westminster ministers get to decide whether Scottish ministers are doing the wrong thing. If so, they can apply a compliance notice, and if they decide they've not met it, they can fine them. I mean, the idea of Scottish ministers being fined by Westminster ministers is just offensive. You know, it's outrageous.
Yeah, it's gone from you can't even talk to these people, especially not if it's about making your country look positive in their eyes, to now even, hey, look, if we decide we want to get, you know, products from them that are either below standards or just like, well, you're just going to have to sit there and like it.
Yeah, or accept conflict diamonds or goods from a country that's committing war crimes. You know, surely there's got to be some kind of moral compass. But anyway, whether or not that's the bigger trade laws, but all about screwing down devolution, rolling it back, exerting control, muscular unionism, and it's unfortunately not well known that this is what they're doing.
You're listening to Bits and Pieces.
There's a couple of things come up to do with small, quite far-right and quite dangerous parties in some respect. First of all, there was a report in The Ferret about a far-right, Nazi-inspired party, it sounds like, standing in Elgin.
A new far-right political party led by a man who stars himself on Adolf Hitler and spoke at an anti-asylum seeker rally in Elgin has been approved to stand in elections by the Electoral Commission. Alec Yerbury's National Rebirth Party was authorized by the elections watchdog on the 28th of February to field candidates in Scotland, England, and Wales. It is the second far-right group to gain approval from the Electoral Commission, EC, in recent weeks. Last month, The Ferret reported that the Homeland Party was allowed to officially register as a political party despite an intervention from the Home Office, which feared the group had applied by stealth. Yerbury, a Leeds-based former soldier, is the National Rebirth Party's leader and treasurer. Research group Hope Not Hate has branded him as an extremist with alleged sinister ambitions who has made violent statements about political opponents.
What's going on in Elgin that the current far-right parties are not far-right enough for them, even more far-right into downright Nazi parties, think that they can stand there? I mean, OK, Murray is what's got Tory MP, but surely to goodness.
Yeah, you can't put this on the people of Elgin.
Well, OK, they haven't voted for them, but from what that clip suggested, they seem to think that it was fertile ground. So anybody listening from Elgin, be aware that there is this kind of stuff going around. And I mean, it's disgraceful. You've got a far-right Tory party full of UKIP members, which has caused Reform UK to be even more far-right for those people for whom the Tories are namby-pamby centrists. And now you've got Nazis standing because the conventional far-right fascist parties aren't far-right and fascist enough. I despair, I really do. The recent council election in Hillhead, I think it was, the group which was set up by Alistair McConaughey, who is known to any independent supporters who go on marches as Manky Jacket. He's the guy who stands with a loud hailer hurling abuse at marchers as they go past wearing a Union Jack jacket. He has set up a party called Independent Green Voice. The word green is the biggest part of his logo, and the logo used to be a clenched forearm, but now it's a leaf. And since they did that, they've been getting a lot more votes. So if you look at the figures, and John Curtis made this point, if you look at the figures, it's quite clear that votes went to the Independent Green Voice pseudo-Green Party. It's a far-right British nationalist party. When they were knocked out, the votes transferred to SNP and Greens. So it was people mistakenly thinking they were voting for a Green Party. I mean, what is the point of the Electoral Commission if they can't stand up against that?
It is intentionally misleading.
And then the third small party that was in the news, the Workers' Party of Britain, has elected one George Galloway to be an MP in Rochdale. George Galloway, very controversial figure, sometimes makes a good speech. He is quite gifted in speech making. It's just that where it comes from and what it's about. The night after he was elected, he was interviewed by the interviewer who clearly didn't understand how this could have happened.
The Prime Minister is saying
that you are God. We're talking about little Rishi Sunak in the fag end of his prime ministership. Don't talk to me as if he's come down from the Mount with tablets of stone. The things that he says are somehow meant to owe me. They may owe you, they don't owe me.
He says that there are forces here at home trying to tear us apart. He is implying you are a divisive figure. Well, you have run an election campaign that has tried to appeal, particularly, one section of the community.
Who won the election? Me or Rishi Sunak? I've got the democratic mandate here, not Rishi Sunak. He didn't even come second. He was lucky to come third. So don't put to me statements made by Rishi Sunak as if I'm supposed to be impressed by them. He don't impress me much.
We at Sky have spent some time today on the streets of Rochdale, and there are people who say that they feel intimidated by people like you and the people that have supported you.
They have pointed out
that you have concentrated your campaign on foreign affairs, and they worry that Rochdale will not be the winner.
That's my answer to you. I was just elected with a thumping majority by the electorate in Rochdale. That's all that matters to me.
So why are there people in the streets of Rochdale today worried?
Well, people voted yesterday, and they voted for me. Why is that difficult for you to grasp?
Why are there people in the streets worried?
There may be people who didn't vote for me who are worried, but the majority, the thumping majority, voted for me. I've got the mandate, and I'm going to the House of Commons with it.
And it's a mandate, you think, to do what? Because there are people that listen to what you say, what you say about whether or not Israel has a right to exist, what you say about what many Jewish people think are threatening slogans.
We had this conversation last night. Why are you reheating it?
Because in the light of the Prime Minister's...
Telling me about the Prime Minister as if he was Moses.
Do you not respect the Prime Minister?
Do I respect the Prime Minister? I despise the Prime Minister.
You're listening to Bits and Pieces.
And finally to Westminster, where we're going to give the last word to Jenny Jones, Green Party, sits in the House of Lords, and this is her eloquent and incisive summing up of the state of the UK.
I think we are in a terrible mess in this country, and this budget actually, it doesn't do anything for it. And it's not really even a debate at all, because we've got two parties arguing over the same set of policies, while the general public see their taxes misspent on a mix of corrupt contracts and privatised services. It doesn't seem very fair, really. The reality of the UK today is that a lot of hard-working people get paid less than they were a decade ago, while the very richest get even richer. There's been no austerity for Conservative Party donors and the friends of Cabinet ministers. They came out of COVID richer as a result of the fast-track PPE contracts. And now, of course, they're paying less tax with fewer regulations and the ability to stow away their money in offshore trusts. And Brexit has failed to benefit Cornish fishermen or voters in Sedgefield, Wrexham or Lee, and levelling up is an excuse that enables the government to channel public money to marginal Conservative seats. The whole Thatcher project has failed, yet politicians of both the two major parties treat it as sacred text. For example, North Sea oil and gas has made Norway one of the richest countries in Europe from the 1980s onwards, with an oil fund worth approximately $1.4 trillion. Revenue from this fund accounts for a fifth of government spending. And the UK should be even better off, but we handed it all over to the private sector. So the result is energy customers being ripped off in the last 2 years, with record high energy bills and record high profits for the oil and gas industries. Instead of coming out of the last 50 years with a thriving economy, we live in a country where things are falling apart and nothing works. Anyone who walks around towns will see the lack of investment, because councils are struggling. They're going bust up and down the country. The NHS waits are getting longer. Dentists can't be found. And these headline tax cuts will do nothing to reverse the decades-long real terms wage freeze that most workers have faced under successive Conservative governments. And you have to ask, where did all the money that we had when Margaret Thatcher took power? Where did all the money go? And of course, we have 171 billionaires now, which we didn't have before, which is obviously something, you know, we should all be proud of. But you have to ask, why isn't a wealth tax the number one priority for both parties, especially the Labour Party, at the next election? It would enable this country to finally invest in large-scale renewables and the insulation of homes. And a wealth tax, of course, could deliver cheaper energy and lower bills, which is exactly what the majority of us need. Rail privatisation has led to far higher fares at a time when the climate crisis dictates that we need lower fares, more trains, fewer cars. And water privatisation has given a sewage in our rivers, higher bills and a collapsing infrastructure. Plus, water bills are due to go up another £125 on average this year to generate the £56 billion needed to fix our leaky pipes and overloaded sewage system. And oddly, that's a very similar amount to what the water companies have paid out in dividends. They took the money and they didn't do the work. And I don't see any sort of penalty from that from the government. There's been a few fines, but they pay those really happily. And what we should be doing is actually, instead of asking for fines, we should be taking shares. The solution to our economic decline is not privatisation of the NHS or anything else. It's public ownership of railways and water and the NHS, and an end to taxpayers being ripped off by dodgy contracts. The Green Party wants this country to have its future back, and that means really change the way that we manage our economy and the environment that we live in. And it means clean water, clean air and clean politics. We are in trouble as a human race, and somehow nobody seems to get this. They just don't understand the urgency of what we have to do. And so I would argue that this budget's fairly useless, really, and I look forward to sharing the Green Party budget with everybody so you can see what good ideas look like.
That was a fairly comprehensive roundup of everything that's wrong. And because she's talking about England, we at least have nationalised our rail service, we have publicly owned water, things aren't as bad here because of the interventions of the Scottish Government. But it is a damning indictment of Tory rule that money has been siphoned off. You know, all those water companies, they had no debt when they were privatised, and now they've got millions of pounds worth of debt because they've siphoned millions of pounds off to shareholders and they're looking to the taxpayer to bail them out. Thatcher, that old witch, has got a lot to answer for. And yet you've got the Labour Party bleating on about how wonderful she was and how much they admire her. It's like through the looking glass, it really is.
That's capitalism, baby!
It is, and I don't like it. Okay, so that's it for this month.
Goodbye.
And thanks for listening. Bye now.
You've been listening to Bits and Pieces.